Please stand by. We're about to begin. Good day, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the 13th presentation of Inside the Beltway by Drinker Biddle. Now, I'd like to turn the conference over to Mr. Fred Riche. Please go ahead, sir.
Fred, thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Here we are in September, going into the home stretch of 2015. It's hard to believe that the year has gotten away from us in this way, but here we are. And I think at least that's at least partially true because all of the attention and energy that has gone into the fiduciary regulation and the derivative transaction exemptions that were proposed by the Department of Labor. And that is going to be a big part of the program today. Before I get into that, though, let me introduce myself. I'm Fred Riche. I'm chair of the financial services team at Drinker Biddle. That means that the group that I work with and that Brad works with represent service providers to plans, people who sell services, investments, and other products to plan. It's a unique part of ERISA, and that's our day-to-day work. Also with me, as I just mentioned, is Brad Campbell. Brad is the former Assistant Secretary at the Department of Labor for the Employee Benefit Security Administration. Brad recently reminded me that he's still entitled under the rules of government etiquette to be called the Honorable Brad Campbell. So, Brad, at all costs, you are honorable. Brad's practice is much like mine. We focus on service providers and how these issues impact them. As a result, the fiduciary proposal is an area of great concentration for us. As we go through the program today, where we will focus most of our energy on that, we will take questions at the end, and I'll try to make sure to leave some time for your questions because I know this issue is of great importance to many of you all. I also want to remind you all that this presentation is being recorded. I mean, you know, in case that would affect any questions you might ask, you should be aware of that. But also, and more importantly, actually, so that if you or some of your compatriots at work want to listen to the program, in the future, or you want to refer people to the program, please feel free to do so. We'll have it posted on our website at www.drinkerbiddle.com within a few days, and you'll look under the Resources tab. However, even better than that, we're going to send you an email that has a link to the presentation. So in about 3 or 4 days, you should be getting an email that says, 3 or 4 business days, an email that says, here's your link to the webcast, to the September 10 audio cast or Beltway. With that background, I want to make a special note of thanks to NetTixus. As you all know, they have sponsored these audio casts, the Beltway programs, for a period of time now. And without their support, we wouldn't be able to do this. So thanks to NetTixus and thanks to Jim Dolan, who's here on the phone with us. Jim?
Fred, thank you very much. I appreciate it. And thank you for the partnership. I think this is about our 13th session we've done with Drinker Biddle, and we're glad that we're able to bring this information to the marketplace. I want to take a moment and thank everyone for calling in today. My name is Jim Dolan. I work at NetTixus Global Asset Management. We are a multi-affiliate asset manager. We have strategies in fixed income, alternatives, and equities. Our goal is to help our clients lead better financial lives. And I'd invite you to learn more about our firm by going to durableportfolios.com. And with that, I'll hand it over to you, Brad, to begin the discussion.
All right. Well, thanks, Jim, and thanks, Fred. But again, most importantly, thanks to all of you for taking the time every quarter to call in and spend a few moments with us to review what's going on. And, of course, the big thing that has been ongoing and will continue to keep going on is DOL's regulatory package redefining fiduciary investment advice, creating the best interest contract exemption, and all of those associated changes. So we wanted to start out today and take stock of where we are in this process, and where we think it might be going. So where we are is here in August, since last we talked. We had the comment period, the formal comment period, close in mid-July with a tremendous amount of very extensive comments. It's clearly been one of the most commented on rules that EBSA has ever put out, which is appropriate given that this is, in fact, the most complex and comprehensive rule, that, in my opinion at least, that EBSA has ever put out, and is on par with the importance back to the initial regulations in the late 70s and early 80s. So it's important that we've gotten those comments. They also held 4 days of administrative hearings on August 10th through 14th, where they had 26 panels of roughly 3 witnesses each testify, so 4 full days of 8 hours or so of hearings. And they have just released a transcript of those hearings, which has triggered the countdown for the end of the reopened comment period. The comment period that ended in July reopened on August 10th on the first day of the hearings and will now close on September 24th. So we have 2 weeks left for all interested parties to get in their final on-the-record comments, responding to things that were in the comments from the July period, responding to things that came up during the administrative hearings, new information that you want to impart. If you want it on the formal record, something DOL must address and respond to, you have until September 24th to get that filed. Fred, back to you.
Okay, Brad, when do you think we're going to actually see the final regulation on the final prohibited transaction exemptions?
Yeah, so we're all unfortunately just speculating about this because we haven't had the new DOL regulatory agenda come out that gives the formal answer. But our speculation is that working backwards, we're starting with the assumption that the Department of Labor and the White House want this rule to be in effect, to actually be governing conduct before Inauguration Day 2017. In other words, to go into effect during the Obama administration. And if you work backwards from that, that means that if you assume it goes, you know, work backwards from that, with an 8-month delay in the effective date, which is what was in the proposal that we all responded to, then that means they have to publish a final regulation in the Federal Register this coming spring, say March or April of 2016. Which means they're going to be spending the time from September 24th through whatever period it takes them to get a final regulation written, a new economic analysis done, send all that over to the White House for review and the Office of Management and Budget for review to get that out on roughly that time frame. That's a very ambitious time frame, by the way, and raises considerable questions about how the department really can do the sheer volume of work they have to do on that time frame. But I think that's probably the most practical time frame for us all to shoot for, to assume that that's what they're going to try to achieve.
And Brad, I think people who follow the rules, there's two different dates they're hearing. They're hearing the effective date. I mean, what you just talked about was a publication date, which was like
right.
March or April, I think you said. And they're hearing the effective date also. So you got the date that's published in the Federal Register, you got the effective date, and you got this other date that the Department of Labor is calling the applicability date. Could you lay out the differences between those three dates for us?
Yeah, well, this is where all things get fun and complex through the Administrative Procedure Act and the rules by which a rule is put out. So the date that the rule is published in the Federal Register is the date that the final language would be publicly available for us all to look at and react to.
And that's the congressional. That's the first time we'll see it, right? Yeah.
That's right. That's the first time anyone outside of the administration will see what their final decisions are. Then, under the Congressional Review Act, there is a 60-day delay before a rule of this magnitude can go into effect, i.e. become a regulation that's good law, so to speak. So there's that 60-day deadline before the regulation is sort of fixed as a regulation. Then the question beyond that is, at what point does the department require us to actually comply with what's in the regulation? And in the proposal, they put in an 8-month delay from publication. In other words, 8 months after the reg would be published is when we would have to begin complying with its provisions. Now, in the actual proposal, there was no transition rule to speak of other than a limited rule within the BICE exemption or BIC exemption that applied in some cases but not others. So that might be an issue that could affect it. For example, one of the questions is, will that 8-month delay stay 8 months? And many commenters requested it to be much longer given the amount of work that has to be done to bring various parties into compliance. So it's possible DOL could have a different effective date or could have a rolling effective date where some portions went into effect earlier than others. These are all things that we're going to be looking for and talking to the department about over the next 6 to 10 months.
So in effect, then, what is formally called the applicability date probably more understandably could be called a compliance date. That's probably the easiest way
to think of it, right? We're assuming the compliance date will be 8 months after the publication date because that's what was in the proposal. That may prove to be partially true depending on how they change that date and whether it's universally applicable or only applicable to portions of the final rule. And obviously, yeah, I do want to reiterate that many, many commenters looking at this said there's just no way we can do the things you want us to do in 8 months. So it may well be the department recognizes that and makes some changes, but we'll see.
Yeah. Okay. Well, there you go. I mean, by our best guess, somewhere around December 31 of next year, a little less than a year and a half from now, it's somewhere in that general time frame, give or take a few months, is the applicability date. So what we're about to talk about, you're going to have to comply with them. So let me just try to give you some general framework before we get down into the weeds of where I see this going in terms of the substance of it, now that we know the timing of it. It appears that the Department of Labor is committed to a very broad definition of fiduciary. That's not to say they're not going to tinker with it some, but the concept of fiduciary advice is going to be very broad. I get the sense that part of the reason for that is a concern by the Department of Labor that if they draft a narrower definition, that people will figure a way around it. And I know that the Department of Labor is disappointed, for example, in how people didn't do the 408B2 disclosures the way the department had hoped that they would be done. And so I think that created a little bit of ill will within the Department of Labor. And now their philosophy has changed somewhat to draft broad rules and then create exceptions. So I see a broad definition of fiduciary advice in the final regulation, and I see but I see two sets of exceptions. One set of exception would be what the Department of Labor is now calling carve-outs, and that it is a carve-out from the fiduciary definition, meaning that all of these activities are fiduciary activities, except we're going to carve out some within that fiduciary world. And we'll give you some examples of that in a minute. The second set of exceptions aren't really to the fiduciary proposal. They're to the prohibited transactions. And let me introduce that subject before I talk about the exceptions. The fiduciary rule itself needs to be discussed separately because somebody either is or is not a fiduciary. And if they are a fiduciary, then they have a duty of prudence, a duty of loyalty, and so on. There are certain duties that are associated with fiduciary status. And that has nothing to do with commissions or anything else. It's just, it simply has to do with fiduciary status. So your compensation has to be reasonable if you're a fiduciary. You have a duty of loyalty to the customer or to the investor. And you have to engage in a prudent process to develop your recommendations. That's a fiduciary. But once you're a fiduciary, there are a set of prohibited transaction rules in the Internal Revenue Code and in ERISA that say, as a fiduciary, you can't do these things. So those prohibited transactions only apply to fiduciaries. Now, I'm not talking about all the prohibited transactions. I'm just talking about this limited set of prohibited transactions. But they only apply to fiduciaries, and the minute that you are a fiduciary, then you have to beware of those. For example, the two that you most commonly see are that a fiduciary cannot give investment advice that would cause themselves to receive a payment from a third party. Well, who's a third party? An insurance company might be a third party. A mutual fund, like a 12b1 fee, would be a payment from a third party. So it's in the prohibited transaction rules that you start to get into these commission areas. The other common prohibited transaction is that you can't give fiduciary investment advice where you can increase your compensation by virtue of the advice. So if I can recommend a mutual fund that pays zero 12b1 fees, one that pays 25 basis points, and one that pays 50 basis points, then the recommendation of the 25 or 50 basis point mutual fund would increase my compensation. Obviously, they're both greater than zero. So that's the other one. That's the other prohibited transaction rule. You can't increase your compensation, and you can't get payments from third parties. But there are exemptions. And for a prohibited transaction exemption is an exception to that general rule. So when the Department of Labor says that they're going to allow commissions, what they're really saying is we're not going to specifically mention exemptions, and we're going to create some exceptions where it may be possible to be paid via commission. And we'll get into that in a minute, because in some ways it's difficult, particularly for non-insurance products and for variable annuities sales to IRAs within the insurance world. So non-insurance plus that. Okay, so then you have the exceptions there. So broad prohibited transactions also for fiduciaries, but then exemptions, which create some exceptions there. So, Brad, with that broad definition, let's treat the fiduciary proposal and the prohibited transaction exemption separately. Let's just pick them and put them into two separate pots, because as I said, I think each one needs to be understood on its own right. So let's start off with a fiduciary proposal. And let's assume that the people listening to this call have at least more than a passing familiarity with what the proposal says, or at least that they accept that it's a very broad definition. Where do you see some changes going forward? That is, between where we are today with the proposal after the comments and the hearings and everything, and what we think is going to come out late next spring, what do you think the changes are going to be?
Well, obviously that's the big question we're all looking at, is on all the various comments and points that were raised, where is the department receptive to some of the points that were made? One of those is, I think, is pretty clearly going to be coming in the education carve-out. In other words, this is conduct that DOL, if you do it within the parameters that DOL describes, would not be fiduciary conduct in the first place. So it says, Fred said, it's not an exemption from the PT rules, but rather, if you give education the right way, you're not giving fiduciary advice. And one of the points that they had put in the proposal was to change a core element of Interpretive Bulletin 96-1, which currently governs this distinction between education and advice. And one of the elements of that is that an advisor can give a participant a model asset allocation portfolio, which says by asset class, how should someone like you be invested? And you're also allowed under the current standard to provide examples from, say, the plan investment platform, the plan menu, of which investments match with which type of asset class. And in the proposal, the department said, we'll let you do the model portfolios, but you can't reference any specific investments. And there was a great deal of pushback on that from the regulated community, saying, look, this undermines the purpose of education. You know, participants aren't going to go out and do all the legwork to connect all the dots to figure out which of their plan investment options is the, you know, mid-cap or large-cap or, you know, international equity or whatever it might be. So we really need to retain this ability to make examples. And during the administrative hearings, the department seemed to be, now of course this is like reading too much into a Supreme Court argument, but the department seemed to be saying, well, what if we tweaked that a little and said, you can go ahead and use examples, but you have to provide all of the available plan investments that fit into those asset classes. And commenters respond to that in various ways, suggesting that while that might make sense for a limited plan menu, it wouldn't solve the problem on an IRA platform where there might be, you know, thousands of available investments. But this is an area where it seems like the department is hearing the criticism, wanting to make some changes to try and preserve some of the educational value that's been going on, especially in light of the fact that, you know, we're not familiar with, and I certainly didn't see any evidence that the department had provided, that this is an area where there's been abuse or any examples of concern.
Yeah, I would, just to echo what Brad said, there were even participant organizations that said, you know, that's very helpful to participants to have asset allocation models. So groups that otherwise supported the fiduciary proposal as a package were also saying, hey, give some relief to participant education. And it seems to me that the arguments were what Brad said, that there hasn't been any pattern of abuse there that people are aware of, even if it may look like a recommendation. Another argument that was made that I thought was pretty good also was that, wait a second, the fiduciaries have selected all these investments for the plan, so they've been vetted by fiduciaries. And, you know, trying to think forward about this, I think that if I were an advisor or a plan sponsor, I would probably think about just limiting my investment lineup to one investment alternative in each asset class that would be included in the asset allocation models. I think that is going to simplify the use of asset allocation models greatly in the future, because these issues only come up if I think particularly with the changes the DOL will make, the issue will only come up where there are multiple options within the investment category that's included in the asset allocation model. And I agree with Brad. It seems like the DOL and some of the commenters, particularly the participant organization commenters, said that's okay for plans, but where it's for IRAs, where, for example, an IRA investor might have 2,000 mutual funds on the platform, for someone to take those and narrow those down to 7 or 8 that are in the asset allocation model is should be considered a fiduciary act. And I think the DOL will probably allow it for plans but not for IRAs because I think they buy into that argument. Brad, you were pretty much saying that, right?
Well, that's not the conclusion I hope they reach. What I was saying is I think the what appeared to be sort of a compromise DOL was floating would probably work with respect to plans, where generally there's a limited menu. So I don't know that I would agree that plans need to go to a one investment per asset class model. I think DOL probably would allow them to just list all of them. And in most plan menus, you're not going to be dealing with, say, more than at most 40 or 50 funds typically. So it would be a fairly finite menu within that compromise. I think the bigger concern, and this is where DOL made a step forward, is saying we're going to expand education to include not just participant discussions, but also IRA owner discussions. And that's why I think one of the bigger issues is going to be, will they allow some narrowing of those options in conjunction with asset allocation models in the IRA platform space? And I think the argument would be that IRA owners need this assistance just as much as plan participants do, and there ought to be a way to address both of those.
My point on that was I think it'll be easier if within a plan, if you just have one in each asset class, because then you won't have to educate participants on the other ones that fit within that same investment category. Because I think depending on how the Department of Labor says you have to address the other funds that are in the plan, in those same investment categories, it could actually end up looking fairly complicated to participants. And I think actually the average plan has more like 20 investment options than 30 or 40, and the trend is downward. If you look at the trend lines, it's to have fewer investment options, not more. So I think there's a chance to simplify the lineup and just make it a lot easier to deal with whatever the Department of Labor does. My other point was not that I want to see the Department of Labor not allow asset allocation models for IRAs, but that I don't think they're going to allow asset allocation, populated asset allocation models for IRAs because of their concern that it looks too much like investment advice.
I agree that that's probably their concern. I would just encourage those folks listening, you've got 2 more weeks to come up with some suggested language of how you could square that circle and see if you could convince DOL to allow that to happen in the IRA space as well.
Yeah. What are some of the other issues in the fiduciary proposal, Brad, that you think of it could be either that people have urged changes and you don't think that there will be changes, or where people have urged changes and it seemed like the DOL was receptive?
Well, one area which obviously has been a source of a great deal of controversy is the large plan carve-out that was in the proposal, which was essentially saying that you could have non-fiduciary information, whether it typically thought of as sales activity, occurring to a plan that had more than 100 participants or more than $100 million in assets. But you couldn't have that same activity occur with respect to smaller plans or IRA owners or participants. And there was a great deal of concern about that being discriminatory against small plans, questions about, you know, what is so magical about large plans that they should continue to have choices that others shouldn't. And What I thought was most interesting about the back and forth that I saw during the hearings was that DOL officials asking about this large plan carve-out and the sellers, and what I think most folks are advocating for instead of the large plan carve-out is a broad seller's exemption, which is akin to what DOL had in the original proposal in 2010, where they said if, you know, both parties should know this is not advice but is a sales conversation, then it's not advice. And a lot of people are urging DOL to return to that. It's interesting to me that in the give and take in the hearing, the DOL officials almost seem to be pushing back against the notion of a seller's exemption at all, which I thought was kind of odd given that their proposal at least restricted it, at least retained it, even if it did restrict it to large plans. That's an area where I think everyone, a lot of commenters are pushing for a broad seller's exclusion rather from fiduciary advice. I think DOL is probably not going to make a lot of accommodation there, unfortunately, but that is one where there's a great deal of discussion.
Now, something that's a little bit different, but it'd be good to know what you think about it, is that the definition of fiduciary investment advice now includes a recommendation to take a distribution from a plan or a recommendation to take a distribution from an IRA. Do you think that's going to stay in there?
I think that will stay in there, but I'm cautiously optimistic that DOL will modify that, and the reason is a lot of the commenters suggested some very practical problems with the very broad definition DOL used. For example, a common part of education is telling someone to consolidate their accounts, to take their old 401k balance and roll it into the new plan, to take whatever IRAs they have floating around and roll them into the new plan so that the funds aren't lost and the participant benefits from larger accounts, et cetera, et cetera. The problem is under the way DOL wrote the fiduciary standard for that, just a recommendation regarding the advisability of a rollover or other distribution, would capture that. So if an educator said, hey, you ought to go ahead and roll your old 401k into the new one, that would be fiduciary advice, and that's going to trigger all sorts of potential complications. And a lot of the pushback on that said, well, wait a minute, this avoids leakage. This is something DOL generally has wanted us to say, and this is an important part of working with participants so that they do keep their funds together. I think DOL might address some of those concerns. One potential would be an exclusion from fiduciary advice for plan-to-plan rollovers, for example. There are a lot of ways they could do it. Another aspect of this that's curious is when you look at the portability between governmental and ERISA plans, you would have a weird outcome, and that's a technical legal term, the weird outcome, where a rollover recommendation to someone who's in, say, a 403B, a governmental 403B, to roll out of that into an IRA would not be fiduciary advice because this doesn't apply to the 403B that's a governmental 403B, but a recommendation to consolidate in that 403B to pull an IRA into the 403B would be fiduciary advice because it's coming from the IRA. So there's some stumbling blocks around all of this that I think DOL hadn't fully thought out in the proposal and they're hearing a lot about since.
If you look at the more classic scenario, which is an advisor making a recommendation to a participant to take their money out of a plan and roll it into an IRA, do you think that's going to continue to be part of the definition of fiduciary investment advice?
I do, because I think that is, in fact, the reason DOL and the White House are so hot on this proposal to begin with. If we look back at 2010, it really was a proposal that DOL initiated about plans and who's a fiduciary to a plan, and they kind of threw in the IRA side as an afterthought, as you can see from their economic analysis in 2010, which didn't even mention IRAs. Here, I think it's concerns about IRA rollovers that are really driving the policy. I think DOL and the White House and other federal officials are looking at the flows and saying all of this ERISA money is going to end up in IRAs, or a very large chunk of it will, and that's something we want to really focus in on and make sure that the advice that occurs at the time of that rollover is being, from their perspective, well regulated.
Now, one thing I wanted to just add to this is this probably doesn't apply to most of y'all, but there is some concern about wholesalers that if the fiduciary, part of the definition of fiduciary is if you're a fiduciary, if you give investment advice to a fiduciary. Well, if all of the advisors become fiduciaries, which is a slight exaggeration, but a lot of advisors, most advisors, would become fiduciaries, then when a wholesaler makes a recommendation to a fiduciary advisor, that would make the wholesaler a fiduciary. That argument has been presented to the Department of Labor, and they seem receptive to saying, oh, no, that wouldn't be, we didn't mean for that to happen. So my best bet, looking forward to next spring when we see the final regulation, is that there'll be some sort of a clarification and maybe even a carve-out on wholesaler-type situations, which could impact mutual fund wholesalers, retirement plan wholesalers, insurance wholesalers, and so on. But that's an open issue. I think it's moving in the right direction. Well, Brad, that's I mean, it seems to me in what we just talked about that we've sort of said that it looks like the fiduciary definition in chief is moving forward, basically with the big provisions being as is, but with some fairly significant definitional and carve-out changes that would affect certain scenarios, but they wouldn't really gut the package, gut the broad definition. Is that a fair representation?
In my opinion, if anything, that's probably a little generous to the department in the degree of change that they're likely to adopt. I think they are certainly going to make modifications to address some of the things that you and I just discussed. But, for example, one of the core problems with the fiduciary definition is you can't. There's no comfortable coexistence with someone who is offering proprietary products unless there's a broad seller's exclusion. And unless DOL goes down expanding that seller's exclusion, I think we're going to have some significant problems dealing with proprietary products and related issues. And just from the tenor of the hearings, DOL didn't seem very eager to expand the large plan carve-out at all. And I think that's a major problem going forward.
Okay. Good. Well, let's move on to the proposed changes to prohibited transaction. Exemption 84-24, which generally applies to insurance product sales to IRAs, participants, or plans. And let me introduce this subject, and then we'll give Brad a chance to see if he sees some things that I missed. But 84-24, as the title suggests, was issued by the Department of Labor in 1984. So it's almost 21 years old. And it's been around for a while. One reassuring thing that you should take from our conversation today is that I work with two different insurance companies plus a broker-dealer, all of whom have used the existing 84-24 for years for sales of insurance products to plans. In other words, they've complied with the conditions of 84-24, and the good news is that they've been successful in the conduct of their business. So it looks like you can live with the conditions of 84-24. But, as I said, it's going to be amended. There's a proposed modification. And without getting too far down into the weeds, let me mention what I think are the three biggest changes. The first is that with the broadening definition of fiduciary, that means a person who would be selling or advising or recommending about insurance products to retirement plans or IRAs, big change, or IRAs, would be a fiduciary subject to the best interest standard. Now, keep in mind that best interest is really just a combination of the prudent man rule and the duty of loyalty. So the person making a recommendation about the insurance product, whether it's a group annuity contract or a traditional annuity to a plan or an IRA, would have to, a group annuity to a plan, individual, a traditional annuity to an IRA, would have to act in the best interest of the investor. And they'd have to, perhaps even more importantly, engage in a prudent process to vet the insurance company and the terms of the annuity contract. So that's the fiduciary standard, in effect. I think that's a big deal. And I don't believe that has been thoroughly discussed in the retirement plan community. But the fiduciary standard is one big change. A second is, a little bit of a surprise to me, that the compensation and costs can be no more than reasonable. Compensation to the advisor, cost to the annuity can be no more than reasonable. Because I'm a retirement plan guy primarily, this concept of the reasonableness of expenses and reasonableness of compensation feels old hat. But in talking to people in the IRA world, it's creating quite a stir. And I'm trying to, my belief is that going forward, much like in the retirement plan world, there'll be benchmarking services and all kinds of information that will help broker-dealers and insurance companies develop standards for reasonableness of compensation. The third big change is that historically and currently, 84-24 covered all insurance product sales. The Department of Labor carved out and moved over to the best interest contract exemption that Brad will be discussing in a minute. They took out the sales or recommendations of individual variable annuities to IRAs. And the Department of Labor, in effect, said because the SEC, the Securities and Exchange Commission, says that individual variable annuity contracts are securities, or variable annuity contracts are securities, we're moving the recommendation of variable annuity contracts to IRAs. We're going to treat it as a security also, and we're moving it over to the best interest contract exemption. That has been a matter of great controversy and tremendous number of comments. The insurance industry in particular, but broker-dealers also have responded that, wait a second, if an investor, an IRA owner, is going to want some guarantee, they're going to look at traditional fixed annuities, fixed indexed annuities, and individual variable annuities. Those are three competing products, and the disclosure and presentation scheme should be the same for all three. Whatever it is, it ought to be the same for all three. Because otherwise would create confusion if you have to make entirely different sets of disclosures about the variable annuities as compared to the fixed and the traditional and the fixed indexed. Brad, on that last one, I'm sort of with my ear to the ground a little bit hearing that the Department of Labor is not inclined to move individual variable annuity sales to IRAs back to 84-24, but then occasionally I hear a report that they might. What are you hearing out there?
Yeah, I've heard both versions of that as well. I am very hopeful that folks can convince the Labor Department to modify 84-24 to include the individual variable annuities, but potentially look at some additional conditions or other ways to address the concerns that caused them to put it in vice. And the reason is as you just described, you're going to end up with fundamentally different disclosures that are going to confuse the heck out of participants, as well as some real restrictions on how one could even offer, you know, how do people get compensated for selling individual variable annuities under BICE that just don't comfortably coexist with insurance products. And I think DOL overestimated, you know, simply because these are securities in the sense that they're, you know, registered. It doesn't seem to me that the other features are actually really the same. And I think overall this would work much better if 84-24 had individual variable annuities back under its umbrella, and negotiations with the department could work out some ways to make that address the concerns that they have. You know, there seems to be this perception that there's some abuse there, but again, this isn't a case where we saw any real evidence of abuse, and the individual variable annuity is really one of the only opportunities for most participants to get guaranteed income, because something like only 5% of plans, even or 5% of participants are in plans that offer any kind of guaranteed income. So it really is an important avenue for participants to get access to guaranteed income, which the department has generally wanted to encourage. So I'm hopeful that the rumors we hear that they want to talk about it are the accurate ones, and not the rumors that they don't.
Yeah. Well, you know, now what I've suggested, I think you all at least have picked up the implication of what I've said, that the best interest contract exemption or BICE is more difficult than 84-24. I'll introduce Brad's discussion of BICE by saying that 84-24 looks like it might be workable with some tinkering. No doubt there need to be some changes because some of it just doesn't make sense. But it's more at the margins with 84-24. The best interest contract exemption simply was not workable at all. I mean, it just would not work. And so my suspicion is that of everything we've talked about today, that's where we're going to see some major changes. Brad, having stated my suspicion, why don't you pick up that ball and run with it?
Well, it's certainly my hope that this is where we'll see some major changes, but without doubt, this is where we're seeing a tremendous amount of activity being directed at the department to seek changes. And the reason, as Fred said, is it simply doesn't work as it was proposed for a variety of reasons. One of the issues that the department put in there, which I think has caused consternation all over the place, is this list of assets. In other words, the exemption is only available when advisors are discussing certain assets that are listed. This, by the way, is a concept, this legal list concept under trust law is something that was rejected by ERISA in favor of the modern portfolio theory. This is really kind of a throwback to the early part of the 20th century on how one would invest. And what's odd about it is there doesn't seem to provide any additional protection the way they set up their proposal. But nonetheless, it raises real concerns because if the asset that an advisor or, more importantly, a participant wants to talk to an advisor about isn't on the list, then BICE isn't applicable. And so this could be a big issue in rollovers, particularly for managed accounts. You know, if I'm a participant in a managed account in a 401k and I want to do a rollover to a managed account in an IRA, if there's a privileged transaction issue, for example, if the fees are not level such that I definitely need an exemption as an advisor to do this rollover, it may simply not be available because discretionary management, managed accounts aren't part of this list of acceptable BICE assets. That's one issue. Another big overarching issue, and unfortunately this is one where...
Can I jump in? I just wondered, there's a lot of confusion about this definition of assets and BICE, and Brad alluded to one thing. I just want to pick up on it and emphasize it. No, I want to make another point. And that is, if you're a peer-level fee advisor and you say, I'll recommend private equity funds, hedge funds, investment managers, all kinds of investments, but I only get my, 25, 50 basis points, 100 basis points, whatever, that's all I get. And to the extent that any of these guys have any finder's fees or anything, I'll offset it against your fees. There is no prohibited transaction there. You don't need BICE, and therefore that limitation does not apply to you. On the other hand, to the extent you're getting variable compensation and you would make more money by recommending a private real estate, non-publicly traded real estate, private equity partnership, a hedge fund, and you recommend that, then that would be variable compensation. That would be a prohibited transaction, and then you would need the exemption. The problem, obviously, is that these things all pay at different levels, so it's really hard to levelize compensation. Therefore, for most people, it will be necessary to have BICE, but then BICE only permits, and this is sort of the reverse of what, or the inverse of what Brad was saying, instead of what it excludes, what it permits is publicly traded securities, mutual funds, collective trusts, insurance products, banking products, and government-issued bonds, for example, federal treasury bonds, notes, and bills. So they're either government-issued securities or they're all heavily regulated, the insurance industry, the banking industry, the mutual fund industry, and so on. And so it appears because they only permit heavily regulated investments that they're saying, gee, we don't know that the average IRA investor understands all these other products well enough, or maybe these other products could be dangerous. But no matter how you cut it, no matter what the rationale, Brad's point is well taken. It is the government, in effect, favoring certain kinds of investments over others, where maybe the approach would be, better approach would be to require a more rigorous disclosure regime. It doesn't seem quite right for the government to be doing that. So Brad, there you go.
Yeah, and that highlights one of the other big issues with BICE, which is, does it even permit variable compensation? And generally, it does not at the advisor level. So this raises questions about exactly how it fits in the context of a rollover. Is the language in BICE specific enough to address a scenario where an advisor was getting 25 basis points on a plan but 80 basis points in an IRA? And it's prudent. Everyone wants this IRA to go through. It's not questioned that it's, in fact, against the best interest. It is in the best interest to go ahead and do this transaction. But does BICE clearly cover that rollover, and if so, on what terms? It's a good example of what Fred was saying, where you have different levels of compensation going on, and there are just structural differences between these products that BICE at least appears to have been intended to address, but doesn't clearly address. And so fixing those questions about how it defines compensation and what it means to have to levelize that compensation so that there is no incentive for the advisor to act against the best interest, those are all critically important details. And, of course, the other big issue there is DOL has essentially outsourced enforcement of this. So it's not going to the IRS under the normal sort of imposing an excise tax for a violation, but rather is converting this into a contract enforceable in state court in a class action under contract law or potentially tort law for warranty misrepresentations. That's a huge issue because so many of these conditions are subjective. For example, if an advisor is using a neutral factor like time to say that it takes more time to advise on this annuity than it does on this index fund, and therefore I had to charge a different amount because of the different amount of work, who's to say what the right amount of time was? And you could see tremendous litigation risk in all of these subjective decisions that have to be made under BICE, such that it really raises some tremendous concerns for people who would seek to use it as DOL apparently intended it to be used. So I think there's just a lot more fighting on BICE to be done. Unfortunately, I'm not very optimistic that DOL is looking to change this state court enforcement, but to me it's one of the major barriers to it being actually useful and something that advisors could wrap their arms around.
Yeah, but just to put a minor positive note on what Brad says, but emphasis on minor, it appears that the Department of Labor is willing to, initially in the proposal, it said that the contract would have to be signed in effect before recommendations were made, recommendations about investing in an IRA, recommendations about rollovers, recommendations about, you know, where you have variable compensation for a mutual fund platform plan. That there would have to be a contract signed before those recommendations or advice could be given. Based on comments, it appears that there's a willingness to say, okay, you don't have to have that contract signed before you introduce yourself, your services, your concepts, your investment approach, but that you then later, before any recommendation is acted on, you have to sign a contract, a tri-party contract between the financial institution, for example, the broker-dealer, the registered representative, and the, in my example, IRA investor, would have to be signed before any recommendation is acted on or is implemented, and the contract would have to be retroactively effective to the initial conversation. So, you know, I agree. It looks like they're going to continue to have that contract requirement, which isn't that big a deal, I don't think, for retirement plans because, for the most part, you know, people are already doing 408B2 disclosures at point of sale. They're doing account opening forms. They're doing investment advisory agreements. They're doing record-keeping agreements. I mean, the 401k world is pretty populated with agreements. But in the IRA world, that would be, I think, revolutionary, the concept that, because usually I think there is an acceptance of the investment recommendation and the implementation and the contract occur more or less together. In any event, I see that as a pretty big change. Are you reading the tea leaves the same way, Brad?
I think the way the department has stated is they want the principle that there is something holding the advisor to a standard they can be judged against and have an enforceable mechanism for holding the advisor to a contract. Reading the tea leaves, to me that sounds like they're seeing state court still as the only viable way to do that. I hope that's not the case because I also have some other questions. I think, for example, the BICE would apply to participants, and I think DOL lacks the legal authority to create an exemption, an alternative remedy to ERISA's exclusive remedies, which in my view is what this is. So I think there's some other legal issues here that we'll hear more about as this moves forward.
Okay. Well, Brad, I think we're pretty much out of time on the fiduciary proposal. If you'll do a 30-second update on state-sponsored plans, I'll do a 30-second update on Tibble, and then we'll open it up to Q&As.
All right. Well, in 30 seconds, we're seeing a remarkable policy change taking place in ERISA, which is you have a number of states who are looking to establish what are essentially variations on an idea of a mandatory automatic payroll deduction IRA for workers, and presumably in cases where there isn't an employer-provided plan. California has something called Secure Choice. Illinois passed a law, et cetera. President Obama directed the Labor Department to put out a regulation that would clarify that ERISA does not apply to these state-based payroll deduction IRA programs. We don't know exactly mechanically how they're going to do that, but we do know that they have followed his direction, and on September 1st, they sent to the Office of Management and Budget at the White House a proposed regulation. And so we're on track to see DOL issue a proposed regulation exempting states from ERISA coverage when they start offering what are essentially investment vehicles to workers on a payroll deduction basis. That gives them time to actually get to a final regulation before the end of the Obama administration. This is something we should all keep our eyes on because it, one, can lead to potentially 50 different variations on some state law on this. But two, it raises real questions, I think, about what, you know, are the states going to be in charge of deciding what investments are appropriate and what fees are appropriate? And, you know, giving away this ERISA jurisdiction, I think, is a pretty significant policy change, but it's something we're going to be watching when that reg comes out.
Yeah, we'll have updates on that as things develop. So tune in December in case something's out by then. On Tibble, let me give you three takeaways in 30 seconds. Number one, the Supreme Court held, in essence, that there is an independent duty to monitor. That is, a fiduciary can be sued on the duty to monitor, the failure to monitor prudently, the same as they can be sued on the failure to prudently select investments. So there is a separate independent duty to monitor that has a six-year statute of limitations in its own right. And so I don't think that's going to come as much of a shock to y'all, but it will to some people. So yes, there is really is a duty to monitor. Number two, the trial court found that the failure, in effect, the failure of the Edison International Plan Committee's, the failure of the Plan Committee to select institutional share classes when they had the capability to do so, but instead they selected retail share classes, was a fiduciary breach. And as a part of that, the defense, the plan committee defended by saying, hey, wait a second, there's a prospectus limit. You have to have a certain amount invested in that mutual fund before you can use the institutional share class. And both sides put on expert witnesses, the plaintiffs and the defense, and both sets of expert witnesses said, well, you know, if you ask, if you're an institutional shareholder, a plan, and you ask, oftentimes, almost universally, the mutual funds will waive the limit. And so the trial court created the duty to ask. You have to ask if a particular share class is available to you, if it might be. So picking the appropriate share class and the duty to ask about it is the takeaway number two. Takeaway number three is, in the amicus brief, the friend of the court brief filed by the Department of Labor, the Department of Labor took the position that it is a fiduciary breach to waste participant money. And while that's not the law, that's simply the Department of Labor's position, if you think about it, that's not just buy the lowest cost share class. That could be applied to buy the lowest net share class. And from what I'm hearing, and perhaps as many as 20% of the cases, buying the retail share class and crediting back the revenue sharing to the participants who own that share class actually produces a lower net cost. So I think in the future we're going to hear more about this concept of the lowest net cost rather than just the lowest cost share class. Well, Brad, I think that completes our formal part. Maybe we ought to go to Q&As. And Greg, Brad and I are ready to do that if you'll open up the lines.
Perfect. If you would like to pose a question, you can join the queue by pressing star 1 on your telephone. Just make sure that your mute function is turned off to allow your signal to reach us. Once again, that's star 1 to join the queue for questions. And we'll pause for just a moment. All right, and our first question today comes from Ken Matson.
Hi, there was a teaser on the email announcement of this particular session about updates on the DOL's progress, quote-unquote, on monthly income disclosures for 401k plans. I didn't hear anything like that, gentlemen.
Well, we ran out of time, and we wanted to allow time for Q&A, but I'll give you the 30-second version of that also.
Thank you.
Yeah, the Department of Labor in July issued Field Assistance Bulletin 2015-02. And the purpose was to explain and amplify on the safe harbor in the ERISA regulations about the selection, the fiduciary selection of insurance companies for providing annuities for plans. So there already is a safe harbor, but people were concerned that the safe harbor was a little vague. And it is, in my opinion, as well. But some of the points raised in the DOL's guidance were there is a six-year statute of limitations. So much as I mentioned Tibble, there's a six-year statute on the initial selection and a six-year statute on monitoring. But, for example, the Department of Labor said once somebody has received a distribution, you know, that a participant's received a distribution, that there is no longer a duty to monitor. Once there's you switch providers, you don't have to, insurance providers, you don't have to monitor the old provider any longer, and so on. So they wanted to assure plan sponsors that they're not going to be liable for something that happens 10, 15, 20, 30, 40, 50 years from now. And they did that through the statute of limitations argument. They also wanted to assure plan sponsors about that same issue, but viewed slightly differently. That is, well, what happens if the insurance company goes broke in the future? And what they said is, no, your job is not to have a crystal ball about the future. Your job is to look at the information today and say, based on the information that we have available today about the financial stability of the company, is it likely to make the annuity payments in the future? And if the answer is yes, then that's a prudent decision or a prudent monitoring, a prudent selection. And you're not going to be liable if, we have another severe economic period and the insurance company happens to go broke 30 years from now. Now, there is a duty to monitor, but they put out specifically that there's no duty, there's no established duty, like you have to monitor every year. There's not like a specific time frame, but you have to monitor as is reasonable. And they gave one example of if there's a significant downgrade by one of the major underwriters. It says, for example, if a red flag about the provider comes to the fiduciary's attention between, you know, regular reviews, a major insurance rating downgrade, then you would need to do an updated monitoring at that point in time. So they're essentially trying to reassure people that, yes, you can look at today's information, you can make a prudent decision, and you're not going to be liable, you know, a quarter of a century from now for that decision. But then, of course, there's always the duty to monitor.
Fred, that was, as usual, that was great 30 seconds and very important information for us, but unfortunately I didn't make myself clear. I was curious about any developments on disclosure of projections for monthly income equivalents out of on a 401k statement for participants.
Brad, go ahead.
Yeah, so the Department of Labor was scheduled, according to their official agenda, to put out a proposed regulation that would require at least one of the quarterly benefit statements to show that projection of retirement income, and also presumably get into how you calculate it and whether there's a safe harbor and all of those important questions. That obviously didn't happen in July, and in fact, if you look at the OMB's website, DOL hasn't sent it over to OMB, and usually once they do send it there, there's a 3-month delay before it comes out. So we're a minimum of a quarter away from seeing this proposal. My prediction is that given the heavy lifting they're doing on the fiduciary rule, at best we'll probably see a proposal sometime in the spring, and we won't see a final rule on it in this administration. But the proposal, I think, could be helpful because how they go about requiring that projection to be calculated is actually going to be really important, and it presents a whole lot of technical and policy issues to sort through. So I'm not disturbed, frankly, that they probably won't get to a final rule on that because that shouldn't be rushed. Neither should the fiduciary rule, and we are rushing that. But nonetheless, on the lifetime income projection, I doubt we get to a final rule and probably don't see a proposal till the spring.
I agree. There's a ton of unintended consequences that could fall out of that for participants and misrepresentations. Thank you.
Yep.
All right. Next, we'll move to Cosmo Fortune.
Hello. in the concept of something rolling from a 401k or another plan to an IRA, I think if you thought the assumption was that in the 401k you're using mutual funds or some kind of commingled fund, and you roll into the same thing in an IRA, all that makes sense. But there are fees in mutual funds and cost in mutual funds, transaction costs, trading costs, administration, and others that aren't in, say, an individually managed account that could be in an IRA. So you can pretty clearly draw some lines and say, okay, in an individually managed account in an IRA, the total cost might be 1.5%, whereas in the mutual fund, the expense ratio plus the other expenses might be as much as 3% or even larger. How do you anticipate accounting for, on our side of the game, how do we account for something like that? We're actually saving them money, but it might not be totally in our fee.
Yeah, unfortunately, the way the privative transaction rules work is they don't focus on total costs. They focus on what is the person making who made the recommendation that the participant take their money out of the plan. And so it is compensation-based. And I agree. I think any analysis that you do, but part of either education or a recommendation is to take all of that into account. For example, if you look at FINRA Regulatory Notice 13-45, it talks about part of making a recommendation. For a broker-dealer representative needs to consider a variety of factors, and one of them is the relative cost. And generally speaking, the costs break into three categories: the expenses of the investments, the compensation to the advisor, and the administration of the IRA or the plan. I mean, whether you look at a plan or an IRA, those are typically the three categories. So, and yeah, I think that is a critical part of looking at the what the recommendation to a participant should be. Unfortunately, with the privative transaction rules, they focus on the advisor's compensation. Brad, I don't know if you want to add to that.
Well, I was going to say, Cosmo, thanks for your question, because it gives me a chance to get on my soapbox and shout about the thing that annoys me most about this rule, which is DOL says best interest when they mean ERISA fiduciary standard and the associated prohibited transaction rules, and those are not the same thing. In fact, the prohibited transaction rules can prevent me from advising you to do something that is in your best interest because of my structural relationship or my compensation or something of that nature. This is my problem with this whole approach, is the restrictions that come with ERISA and the prohibited transaction rules are not necessarily acting in the best interest of the participants and significantly complicate a lot of good and useful transactions. I really wish DOL had taken a much more narrow approach to find the bad actors here. Unfortunately, they didn't. But what you just described is a perfect example of how a participant can end up paying less potentially and be better off, but still the advisor not be able to do it. And I think that's an example of a problem with this, well, fundamental problem with this regulation.
Now, I'm just as an aside, I'm working with a number of broker-dealers, call centers, RIA firms, and the like, where based on language and the preamble of the DOL proposal, which essentially and language in Federal Regulatory Notice 13-45, which says in both cases, well, you can either make a recommendation or you can educate the participant and they can make their own decision. So there is a distribution education alternative. And that starts off, and I can only go into so much detail on this call today, but it starts off with the four distribution options: leave your money in the plan, transfer it to the plan of a new employer, take it out and roll it to an IRA, or take it out and pay taxes. Essentially, those are the four options that most people have. But then within those, there are a whole series of considerations. There's taxation, there's flexibility, there's cost, there's advice, and on and on. And what we're doing is we're constructing materials for firms that create a list of what those considerations are so they have something in writing to give to the participants. Then you could also actually construct a basis for helping a participant decide what's the most important to them. And then you would, in your accountant form or advisory agreement, I think you want some acknowledgement from the participant that you provided them with information and education, but not with a recommendation. So you can go the education route without making a recommendation, in which case you don't become a fiduciary for that purpose, and you don't have to worry about all these rules that Brad and I have been talking about. So there is an out. It may not be perfect, but at least for the time being, until we see the final rule, we know that that will work. Let me turn it over to Jim Dolan to make some parting comments, and then we'll talk to you all at some later date.
Certainly. And Fred, thank you very much. And Brad, thank you very much for the informative discussion. We certainly appreciate it. These calls are very helpful. And thank you to all of our callers for participating and for calling in today. Mark your calendars. December 10th will be our next call and the final call for this year. With that, Greg, I'll pass it along to you to end the call.
Jim, we thank you for your participation.